from the musical The Wedding Singer. It's heard here on 90.9, where we're broadcasting live and local, your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly, and welcome to the program for this Thursday afternoon. The Wedding Singer is the production this fall for Illini Student Musicals at the University of Illinois. It opens tonight, continues through Saturday at Lincoln Hall on the U of I campus in Urbana. And we'll be talking with the producer of that program in just a moment. Later on the show, in about 12 minutes or so, I'll be talking with Joanne Folletta, who is the conductor of the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra and also the Virginia Symphony, and she has other conducting relationships around the world. But more to the point, she is on tour with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, and they are performing tonight at the Krannert Center in Urbana. So a little competition for the Wedding Singer. They do happen at the same time. And that concert features Sir James Galway, who we talked to a couple of days ago. We'll be talking to Joanne Folletta coming up very shortly. But first, Michael Courtney, who is producer for The Wedding Singer and also heavily involved in Illini Student Musicals. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having us.
So I said heavily involved with Illini Student Musicals. That begs two questions. What's your involvement exactly? And what are Illini Student Musicals? Because when I was a graduate student at the U of I, I was actually involved in a couple of musicals for the Illini Union Board, and I understand they stopped doing musicals a year or so ago, and you guys stepped into the breach.
We did, yeah. We kind of saw the void coming. Pretty much the group was very heavily involved in that same, the Illini Union Board musicals, and we saw kind of the end coming for some of the productions. And so we decided that we really wanted to keep up the tradition, and we decided to start our own group. And we started off as a registered student organization. Illini Student Musicals has since then turned into a 501c3 charity. And it's been great ever since. We've been having a lot of fun since. We started the organization, we started planning in the spring of 2011, and we had our debut musical production of The Drowsy Chaperone in the fall of 2012, followed shortly by Little Shop of Horrors in the spring of 2013.
So you've had two shows so far.
Two shows so far, with Wedding Singer being the third coming
up. It's a huge deal for a lot of people to go to 501c3. Why did you decide you needed to go that route instead of remaining a registered student organization?
Well, we technically still contain both titles, but we decided to go 501c3 because we were already fulfilling some of the needs and requirements of 501c3. Illini Student Musicals is a charity. It has educational outreach in the Champaign-Urbana community and some central Illinois schools. In particular, musical theater education was our big emphasis last year. And this year, we've been doing a lot of charitable performances for local nursing homes. And again, we'll be picking up with educational outreach here in a few weeks once the craziness of the show dies down. And these musicals that we produce do fund the charity. So this, you know, going to see one of our shows is actually kind of, great for the community too, because the proceeds from that show not only help pay for next year's show, but it also pays for the charity and involves things we might need for any of the educational outreach programs.
So for those who don't know, when one says 501c3, that means a federally and state-recognized not-for-profit organization.
Yeah, exactly, not-for-profit.
Yeah. So when you talk about the charitable programs, do you take elements of whatever musical you're doing around to various places, or are these completely separate activities?
It's a little bit of both. It's combined. We do take people. We have a very talented cast and staff who we work with year in and year out, and they're a very dedicated and hardworking group of individuals, and so they donate their time and their abilities and their talents. And last year, our biggest push so far last year, they donated their times and abilities to work with local schools, in particular University High School, Centennial, and Prairie Middle School, were our three big customers, for lack of a better word. And we worked with them to help them produce shows of their own. We worked with their staff to kind of show them what we've learned along the way and kind of collaborate and exchange notes and kind of help each other out. And we use the resources that the University of Illinois allows us, like the lighting equipment and things of that nature, and we help students learn about how to make costumes or how to hang lights or how to light design or sound design a show. And so these things that students wouldn't normally have access to, Illini Student Musicals kind of fills that void for them. And it comes at no cost to the schools that we go into. So University High School doesn't have to pay for anything that we kind of teach. And, it's great for us and at Illini Student Musicals to be able to give back to the community that's given us so much. And I think it's great for the students who get to, you know, reap the rewards of living so close to a major college, university, and having this great team of dedicated individuals who have so many talents and so much know-how, who can come into their schools and teach them about things they're already interested in learning about.
Of course, you all are students as well, so you're learning while you're teaching.
We are, exactly, yeah. And that's kind of the beauty of the organization. A majority of our members are non-theater or non-fine arts majors. So I'm a finance major, and majority of the organization...
Finance?
Finance, yes. Yeah. A majority of the organization is made up of people who, you know, just really enjoy doing shows and really enjoy doing musicals, don't want to do it for the rest of their lives, or, you know, don't want to make that their career, but aren't ready to quite give it up. You know, they want to be involved in show, and they understand, you know, the camaraderie and the greatness that can come from doing a show. And so that's kind of the beauty of ISM, Illinois Student Musicals, is that we kind of are a melting pot and a mishmash of great talent and different backgrounds of the university.
The Wedding Singer, I probably should have known but didn't know that it was a musical. I knew that it was a movie starring Adam Sandler some years ago.
It is.
Any idea what possessed Broadway or whoever it was to decide to turn this movie into a musical?
You know, it's a great show. It really is a great story and a great plot. The movie is funny, and, you know, it portrays Adam Sandler, who's kind of, you know, a goofy actor. And the movie was great. And I think, in my opinion, the musical is even better. I think it kind of takes out some of the goofiness of a little, and kind of makes it more of a serious show. But it's, to answer your question, Wedding Singer is a great plot because it's something that everybody can relate to. It's about love, finding the wrong love, losing that love, and then finding new love all over again. And kind of the hilarities that kind of ensue along with that path. And it's just adding music to that and make that whole storyline come alive with The Wedding Singer, the musical, is just a phenomenal experience. And add on to that, it is a musical comedy. And it has that nice rock and roll feel. So it's kind of like a rock and roll show. ISM's portrayal of the show is kind of a rock theme, so when you come to see the show tonight, you're going to notice, you know, the lights are set up like you're at a concert, and the stage is set up like you're at a rock show. And so you're going to see the show within a show, and it's just something I think you're all really going to enjoy.
And Robbie Hart is the wedding singer.
Yes.
He's the one who actually does not do a great job as a wedding singer overall.
Oh, no, yeah. At first, he does great, and then after he gets his heart broken, he just can't keep practicing what he preaches. And so he gets his heart broken, and after that he can't be a wedding singer anymore until Julia Sullivan, the love interest, comes along and rescues him.
But of course, it being musical comedy as opposed to musical tragedy,
yes,
one assumes there's a happy ending.
There is, of course, like all good musicals.
but otherwise, if people have seen the movie, they at least know the general plot
line. Yeah, you know the premise then.
Yeah, and probably what you just heard now gives you enough of the premise to, and these couple of samples of music that you're going to hear. The Wedding Singer is the production for the fall of the Illini Student Musicals at the University of Illinois. It's taking place in Lincoln Hall, and I haven't been in the theater since it's been refurbished.
Oh, it's nice. Definitely go check it out. It's beautifully renovated. It's the building on the southwest side of the campus, the main quad, which has been under renovation for years now. We're very lucky. Illini Student Musicals was the first musical production to come back to Lincoln Hall after the renovations. And so we're very proud of that. And we've been in Lincoln Hall now. This will be our third, you know, show in a row that we've been at Lincoln Hall. And it's a great space. We love working there. We love the staff that gets to work there with us. And it's just been working out really great for us. It's beautifully renovated. Definitely worth coming checking out.
Shows are tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30. How does somebody get tickets?
Tickets are available at IlliniStudentMusicals.org. Or at the box office, which opens tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night at 6:30 p.m.
And Michael Courtney is producer for The Wedding Singer. You're not acting in it at all.
I am not the talent, unfortunately. I wish.
Emphasis on finance major.
That's right, exactly.
All right, well, best of luck with the production. And here is another tune from The Wedding Singer. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9.
I want to make you smile whenever you're sad, carry you around when your arthritis is bad. Oh, all I want to do is grow old.
You sing at my wedding.
Yeah!
That was supposed to be yes, with the end of that word from The Wedding Singer here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our program's supported by the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. The Corkscrew's Bouvon Wine Bar features live music on the weekends. This Friday night at 6 o'clock, it's Ark Avrutsky. Then at 8:30, it's The Curses. On Saturday at 6, it's Lamont Parsons. And at 9, it's Clark Gibson's Old Style Sextet. Details available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. Joanne Folletta will conduct the Irish Chamber Orchestra at the Cranert Center for the Performing Arts tonight, featuring a Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway duo flutist in that program. It's a wonderful program, and we're going to be talking with her in just a few minutes. Here is a recording that she made with the Ulster Orchestra in Ireland of music by Gustav Holst. It's the opening movement of his symphony known as the Cotswolds. That's music by Gustav Holst from his symphony in F major called The Cotswolds. And we heard the first movement. There are four of them. And this is a performance by the Ulster Orchestra conducted by Joanne Folletta. This is a piece I had not heard of before or heard, therefore, either. And that is probably as Joanne Folletta might well like it, because she is, among other things, somebody who likes to bring new music to people. Very new music, meaning pieces that hadn't existed before, but also pieces by folks like Holst, who are familiar names, but some of the music of theirs that is not familiar. And she's going to do a little of both of those things when she conducts the Irish Chamber Orchestra at the Cranert Center for the Performing Arts tonight for a 7:30 concert, which will feature Sir James Galway and Lady Jeannie Galway as a soloist and then duo soloists. The program includes a world premiere of at least a particular arrangement of a piece called Carillon Variations. It'll include a piece by Hamilton Hardy called In Ireland, which is not overly familiar at all, and then a couple of pieces that are very familiar, the second of Mozart's flute concertos and the third of Mendelssohn's symphonies. Joanne Folletta is my guest this portion of Live and Local. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm delighted to be here.
Did I characterize your interest adequately?
You did. And thank you for saying that, because I believe that there is so much more wonderful repertoire that people don't know. It's almost as if we keep playing the tip of the iceberg over and over again. Not that there aren't wonderful pieces, but there's so much more. And I'm always delighted when I can find something that people don't know and are surprised by and really like this Holst Symphony.
Is that a piece that, I guess I'm a little curious how you do find certain pieces like that one where... there may be other recordings of them, but certainly not many that people don't run across. And
sometimes recordings can help, but as you say, sometimes you just simply look at the score. You've got to look at the score and make a determination of the value of a piece. It's always a little risky, but in the case of Holst, I thought it was amazing that some of his music was not known at all, given that we know his Planets and then some of his suites so well. So this was a thrill to find this music. Since it was the Ulster Orchestra project, I was specifically looking for UK and Irish repertoire, and I've discovered a lot of United Kingdom and Irish repertoire in my time there now that's really not played at all in the US.
Well, I want to talk about in a minute your various recording projects, and you have a number of orchestras you're involved with and recording with, and I'm sure the what you record varies according to who you're conducting. But sort of coming back to the where you find music, in order to find the score, of course, you had to have known about the piece, and most conductors know about the same pieces, at least initially, that I think a lot of recording people who listen to recordings know. Like, you probably know the major pieces of Holst, but then in order to find out about the Cotswold Symphony, you had to find out about it somehow.
It's true, and I really had to look, and you're right. I mean, most conductors, and myself included, we spend most of our time with the standard repertoire. That's what we learned in school, and that's what we do for probably most of our performing lives. We play great treasures, of course, that people know, but I like to always be on the lookout, whether it's with obscure recordings or reading about a composer. I religiously read Fanfare and American Record Guide, and I've just made many great discoveries there of composers I didn't know, sometimes pieces that I won't record, but just to get an introduction to who the composer is and what his or her style is like, leads me to other pieces that aren't recorded. So, as I said, it's a little risky, but it's a great adventure. And in most cases, I find that audiences are delightfully surprised at some of the music that's never played. Joseph Suk, for example, Dvorak's son-in-law, was just a great discovery for our Buffalo audiences, who wound up loving this beautiful, heartwarming Czech music that they'd never heard of, from a composer they'd never heard of.
What are some of the pieces of Josef Suk's that you'd played?
We did Fairy Tale, which was one of the most beautiful ones, and Scherzo Fantastique, which is beautiful, and the Violin Concerto, Violin Fantasy, which is an extraordinary piece. So there's a lot out there. I'm just going to keep hoping to keep making discoveries for many years to come.
Well, you have to keep discovering in your case, because you're so deeply involved in so many different recording projects, which not all conductors are doing anymore, because particularly with the major orchestras, they in the United States anyway, they don't have recording contracts for the most part anymore, unless they do themselves.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
San Francisco Symphony, who are coming here, I think, next week, they put out their own recordings.
That's right. And those are wonderful.
Labels.
I mean, we're lucky in that we have a contract with Naxos, and particularly so because Naxos is a recording company that doesn't want to have another version of the Brahms symphonies or another version of the Mozart symphonies or the, you know, Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto. They want unusual repertoire. They want repertoire that they don't have. So that's one of the reasons that I have become a great explorer of music, because I keep trying to find projects that Naxos would be interested in of composers that they whose works they don't have. So they've inspired us to do this, and I think they're an amazing company in that they are enriching the repertoire with pieces that people don't know. So we've made a lot of discoveries because of their challenge to us to do that. And in a sense, in a very real sense, it strengthened our orchestra in Buffalo, because when you do recordings, you start to listen in a different way. You know it's going to be for posterity. You know it's going to be down there on the CD. And so it needs to be perfect. And the musicians and I started to listen much more critically for intonation, for ensemble, for momentum, for how we interpreted the pieces. That helped us think about music in a different way, and to listen that way in concerts now as well. So it's been a great tool for artistic development for us.
I guess the thing about recordings is, as you say, it really needs to be in tune. Of course, in a live performance, you want everything to be in tune,
right,
and you work for that. But live performance is over and done, and people aren't going to remember, you know, if they heard something happen, they're not going to remember it, provided the overall product was really good. But if you have a recording,
that's right,
the people are going to listen to it over and over again. Maybe the first time through, they'll think, oh, that was nice. Second time through, that was a mistake. And you just don't want to have that happen.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's much more critical in the passion of the moment in the concert. Little things that are not perfect slip by, and they don't really affect the overall intensity of the performance. But recordings is a document. It's a document of who we are and how well we can play now, that people can analyze in a different way. So it's taught us to be more critical of how we approach everything we do, and that's been very good for us.
Let's back up a bit regarding your own career. You've mentioned two orchestras so far, and I didn't really do any sort of an introduction to you or for you, but let's do that now. You mentioned the Buffalo Philharmonic. You've been the music director there since 1999, I think.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And also of the Virginia Symphony Orchestra. How long with them?
Since 1991.
So I thought that was longer.
Yeah.
And principal conductor of the Ulster Orchestra, which is what we heard in the Holst music, Ulster in Ireland.
That's right.
Appropriate enough for your tour currently with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, I guess. And principal guest conductor of the Phoenix Symphony and the Brevard Music Center. Remind me, where is Brevard?
It's in North Carolina.
In North Carolina.
And it's a summer festival for adults and young people, and it's an extraordinarily beautiful part of the country, and a lot of great music going on in the weeks that it's presenting its summertime festival. So it's a great destination place for students and for audience alike.
How do you juggle all these orchestras?
Well, I have to plan my schedule very carefully, and I go back and forth most of the time between Buffalo and Norfolk, Virginia, and that's a sort of a constant. I'm in Belfast less often, usually 5 or 6 times a year for a week, and I've learned a lot in working in a non-U.S. orchestra about how they function and how government support is so much stronger there than it is here. So it's been a good education for me, too, and the orchestra is really first rate and does a lot of recording now.
What are the seasons like for Buffalo and the Virginia Symphony? How many concerts a year typically?
Well, they run, both orchestras run from September through in June in Virginia's case, July in Buffalo's case, and we do concerts every weekend. Not all classical concerts, though. In Buffalo we do 17 weeks of classics, and in Virginia probably around 12. But that's supplemented with pops and special events and holiday concerts and youth concerts, an enormous number of children's concerts. So like most American orchestras, we are kind of multi-purpose. I mean, we try and provide a vast expanse of different music for our public and in that way really relate to as many people as we can.
And do you have, I mean, it would seem to me if you're doing both of those orchestras and the other activities, you can't conduct all those concerts.
No, I don't. I don't. We have guest conductors. We certainly have an associate who does a lot of them. We have people who come in and specialize in the pops. But when you're a music director, you do sort of have the overall responsibility for what the season looks like, even if you're not conducting the concerts, you know, making the choice of guest artists and guest conductors and repertoire in some cases. You really become responsible for the entire orchestral life.
You hinted at it, you described some of it there, but maybe a little more detail about the role of the music director versus the role of a principal conductor versus the role of just a conductor, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, the music director, at least in the last couple of decades in our country, has become a more and more daunting role, I have to say, because not only are you responsible for what happens musically, and not only in your concerts, but other concerts as well, but you have to get really intrinsically involved with marketing, with fundraising, with strategic planning, with board development, with audience relations, with relations with the press. So you there's a lot that you have to do that you don't learn in music school, I will say that. And it's taught me a lot, and it's been very inspiring. And in the end, it's very satisfying because the relationship that you form with your city and with the people in the community who support the orchestra is a very close one, and you feel like you have partnerships to take care of the Buffalo Philharmonic or the Virginia Symphony, and that is a very, very deeply enriching relationship to have.
What about then as principal conductor in Ulster and Phoenix, you know, or principal guest conductor there, but
right.
Principal conductor in Ulster?
Well, there's less involvement in that, partly, mostly because the orchestra is supported almost exclusively by the government. Mm. So there's not the need for fundraising or strategizing in that way. But there is a need for the principal conductor to get involved in what's happening in shaping the season, in coming up with ideas or plans or themes for the season. This season, for instance, where it might not sound like an American orchestra, but we have a theme of all the Sibelius symphonies and all of the Walton concertos. Mm-hmm. And that has been very successful so far in Ulster to have that frame around what we're doing. But there's probably much less responsibility in the role of principal conductor in a European orchestra than there is in music director in an American orchestra.
Let's give a listen in a moment to some music that you have recorded with your Buffalo Orchestra. But first, let me remind listeners that this is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and our guest is Joanne Folletta, who's guest conducting on tour the Irish Chamber Orchestra, which she will be leading tonight in a concert at 7:30 with the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts here at the University of Illinois in Urbana. And that'll feature soloist Sir James Galway for two pieces, I guess, and then he'll be joined by his wife, Lady Jeannie Galway, for a piece that will have its premiere. No, it's by Philip Hammond, and I hedged a little bit on what kind of premiere it is because I've seen it two different ways.
Well, this tour is a premiere of the orchestral version. Hammond wrote it originally for them with piano only, and because of this tour, they asked him if he would revise it and turn it into an orchestra piece, and that's what he did.
Because I talked with Sir James about it on Tuesday, but we didn't really get into that part of it, so mm-hmm. I'm glad for that clarification. So that's by Philip Hammond. It's called the Carillon Variations after Trilloch o Carillon. But here is music by Ottorino Respighi from his... This is a suite that most people don't know. They know The Pines of Rome and the other... the whole Roman trilogy and some other things. But this is called Church Windows. Tell us about this, the piece overall, and then the second movement, which we're going to hear.
Well, Respighi loved Gregorian chant, partly because his wife was a scholar of Gregorian chant, and she taught him a great deal. And he based these four portraits really on chant, but also on the image of a saint or stained glass window. This is my particular favorite. It's the image of Saint Michael, the archangel, in full battle regalia, I guess, ready to do battle with Satan. So it's a very dramatic moment.
Joanne Folletta leads the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra in this music by Ottorino Respighi here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was music by Ottorino Respighi from his suite of four pieces called Church Windows, that movement representing St. Michael the Archangel. And it was performed by the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta, who was my guest this portion of Live and Local. She is conducting the Irish Chamber Orchestra tonight at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And coming back to the whole topic of recordings, which I said we'd explore a little bit more, particularly your arrangement with Naxos. You've got... I went and looked at their catalog when I knew I was going to be talking to you, and it is staggering, the numbers of recordings that are conducted by Joanne Folletta with a number of different orchestras. How did you start... How did you get involved with them in the first place?
Well, when I became music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic, they actually reached out to me, Klaus Hamann, who's a visionary and an extraordinary man, the founder of the company, and said that he wanted to have an American orchestra recording, especially American music, but other types as well. And we started a relationship with... I think a disc by Frederick Shepard Converse, an unknown early American composer, and we went on to Richard Strauss and Dosh Nani and Joseph Suk and John Corigliano. So we've gone in all different directions with them, some American, some lesser-known European. One of the discs, John Corigliano, Mr. Tambourine Man, won two Grammys. And I was thrilled about that because I thought it was a very important new work. So it's been a great relationship with Naxos, and then we started to record with the Ulster Orchestra, and I've done some things with London Symphony for him as well. But I'm a big fan of Klaus Hamann because I think he's a man with an endless imagination and appetite for new music. I mean, he really is interested in pieces that he doesn't know and wants to get them on his record label.
How have you had to adjust your own life to accommodate all these recordings? Because You've already got two orchestras, much of the time, I'm sure, doing standard works. But to have these kind of recording projects where you have to learn so much music that you would not have been exposed to at all, I'm sure, if not for these projects.
It's true.
Like, whoever heard of Converse?
And right.
Was that their idea?
Well, we really share that responsibility. I come up with a lot of ideas, not all of which they will accept, and vice versa. I mean, they propose ideas to us, too, and many of the things are intriguing, and we do them, and some we don't. So there's lots of emails back and forth about what about this and what about that. One of the projects we did recently, I had proposed to Klaus, and that was the orchestral music of Duke Ellington, which is fantastic. And he hadn't known of it and just fell in love with the idea. And I think it remains one of his favorite of our discs. But we incorporate them into our season. I think the musicians and the audience have come to look forward to, okay, what's up for Naxos this year? This year we're doing early Bartok, romantic Bartok. It's intriguing to see what we're going to discover. It does mean a lot of studying for me, but I think it keeps me fresh because doing music that I don't know gives me a certain perspective on more traditional music. You know, if you're doing a lot of new things and looking with fresh eyes at a score that may not even be recorded, I find that I think about Beethoven in a different way and Dvorak and Mozart because I try and approach them now in the same way as new music, as music that I'm discovering for the first time, and to sort of wipe away a little bit the traditions that we know, oh, it always goes like this, or, you know, this is the way it should be done, and try and look at it fresh. So I find it's really helped me in looking at the standard repertoire as well.
True confessions. Are there times when you've gotten to the recording studio with you know, a bunch of music by one of these composers that was largely unfamiliar to you or anybody else and thought, oh, my God, I wish I had more time to have learned that particular piece?
Well, yes, I have to say unqualified yes. That's probably true of most conductors every week of their lives and certainly of me. We do so much in so little time. You know, we even for our concerts, we have four rehearsals, sometimes a repertoire that's really unknown. And I always wish, wow, I wish we had another week to learn this together. I wish I had another week just to sit in my room and just look at this music. But that's how we grow, I guess. We grow by sometimes doing these things and we accumulate knowledge by living through this music. And it's an endless journey. I mean, for me, that's the beauty of being a conductor. You're constantly learning. You never get to a point where it's even possible to be bored. It's just impossible. I mean, music is so interesting, and there's so much out there, and there's always so much more to learn, even in a piece like the Mendelssohn Scottish Symphony, which I've done a lot, or Mozart Flute Concerto. There's always new things to learn.
Nice transition, because I was going to make it for you anyway, and you just did it for me. Thank you very much. To the concert you're conducting tonight, which does have these standards, the D major flute concerto, which will feature Sir James Galway, and then the Mendelssohn Scottish Symphony. Tell me about the Mozart a little bit. What are some of the reasons you like it?
You know, it's a virtuoso vehicle for flute, and despite the fact that Mozart always claimed he did not like the flute, he writes for it very lovingly, although this particular piece started life, as you know, as an oboe concerto, and then Mozart revised it for the flute. But it's impossible to think that he's not loving every moment of what he's writing for the flute. It's just filled with sparkle, and yet it's filled with a kind of profound feeling as well. You know, Mozart, to me, is really the first romantic composer because there are always hints in his music, even with its restrained elegance and balance and symmetry, of a kind of passionate romantic heart underneath. And we hear that often in his slow movements where he lets that shine through. So it's endlessly fascinating for me to think of this genius writing these works for flute for an amateur flutist and never being paid for them either, because the diplomat de Jean didn't like the music and never paid Mozart for it. So but it's become, this particular one, both of them, the G major and the D major, have become great classics of flutists everywhere. I mean, they're miraculous pieces.
Well, since you mentioned slow movements, here's some of the slow movement of the D major concerto. So James Galway is the flutist. He's also the conductor in this performance with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And he'll perform with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta, tonight in a concert in Urbana at 7:30. some of the slow movement of Mozart's second flute concerto, the D major flute concerto, with James Galway, soloist and conductor of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, and he'll play with the Irish Chamber Orchestra at the Krannert Center for a concert tonight at 7:30. Include that whole piece, of course, and also music by Hamilton Hardy called In Ireland. This is a wonderful piece. It's going to open the program. And then he'll be joined by his wife, Lady Jeannie Galway, for the world premiere of the orchestral version of Carillon Variations by Philip Hammond. The whole concert will be conducted by Joanne Folletta, who's my guest this portion of Live and Local. Does Sir James ever interfere with your conducting?
Well, you know, he's always telling me stories of Herbert von Karajan and what Herbie, as he calls him, used to do in this and what Herbie used to ask for, because that was, I think, his first job, his first big job as principal flute of the Berlin Philharmonic, although he didn't stay for that long, went on to a solo career. But obviously, von Karajan, as you can imagine, made an enormous impression on Jimmy. And he's told me wonderful stories and wonderful anecdotes about what happened in the orchestra and how the orchestra used to play. I mean, amazing, amazing sound with that orchestra.
But does he say these things in order to say, well, this is what you should do too, or just more of an anecdote?
Well, an anecdote, but also he makes suggestions. You know, of course, the Berlin Philharmonic played in a way that everything was long and luscious and very, very kind of tenuto and legato. And the chamber orchestra doesn't. It's much more muscular and kind of angular and very exciting. So the sound is quite different, but he reminds me of when the Berlin Philharmonic used to play these things. They were much slower and much more sustained, but they also had probably four times, maybe five times the number of players that, you know, that a chamber orchestra might have. So
but the tradition at that point was different in how you play Mozart.
Absolutely true. Mozart was played in a much more romantic style.
Of course, you were talking about Mozart as the first romantic, perhaps, but the approach anymore is different for almost everybody, I think.
That's right. That's right. We don't play him in the style that they would have played at the beginning of the 20th century or mid-20th century. And you know what? Mozart is the kind of music that's so perfect that any style, it's wonderful. But we are approaching it with a kind of a fresher ears now. But I still find him very romantic, even in that context. I find his slow movements to be like the harbinger of a romantic age long before Beethoven was pushing us into the romantic age. And I always am very, very moved by that about Mozart in his restrained way, in his elegant, balanced, and unbelievably proportioned way. That he's opening the door to a kind of individual, personal feeling that comes in the Romantic age.
I know we have to let you go because you got to get ready for your concert. But just a few words about the closing work on the program, Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 3, known as the Scottish. I know you're touring another program that includes was it the Mozart Jupiter Symphony?
That's right. That's right.
How'd you decide on these two pieces of all the standard pieces that could work for chamber orchestra?
Well, the chamber orchestra was particularly fond of the Jupiter Symphony, so they helped me choose that. And I wanted to bring something that came from, or is inspired from, their region. I mean, not Ireland necessarily, but Scotland. And the Scottish Symphony was directly inspired by Mendelssohn's visit to Scotland as a young man. Although he worked on it most of his life, he was so struck by the landscape of Scotland. He said everything seemed to be shrouded in a wondrous fog, and the tragic story of Mary Queen of Scots influenced him greatly. So this is something that's so atmospheric, right from Scotland, and I thought, let's bring one of Ireland's neighbors with us, and we've loved playing this piece.
And I'm sure that I actually asked Sir James, said, you don't mind having a Scottish piece on your Irish program. He said, well, they're all Celtic or something like that. Joanne Folletta, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm looking forward to hearing the concert tonight as well. And it starts at 7:30 at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Illinois in Urbana. The Irish Chamber Orchestra with Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway. Joanne Folletta will conduct the concert, and she's been my guest this portion of Live and Local here on FM 90.9. Thank you. Second movement of the Scottish Symphony of Felix Mendelssohn, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Nicholas Harnoncourt. Our program today is made possible by the Champaign Park District, presenting A Far Cry with guests Stefan Milenkovic and Dmitry Kuzov on Thursday, November 14th at 7:30 p.m. at the Virginia Theater. A Far Cry, a self-conducted orchestra, seeks to expand how orchestral music is experienced. This is 90.9 WYNL-FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. We're a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 5 o'clock.